Well, you have two options. Either turn the radio off or turn it up with Power Hour. I'm your host, Disheveled, and we're bringing you the most explosive headbanging rock on the airwaves. From deep cuts from your favorite classic rock bands to the best in up-and-coming rock and roll, we're here to rattle your speakers. Don't miss Power Hour every Thursday night at 7 p.m. here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host of this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show anytime, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Abigail Bergeron, who is doing her PhD in philosophy under the supervision of Dr. Paul Fairfield. Welcome to Grad Chat, Abigail.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And before we dive into your research, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your academic journey up until this point. So where have you been and what brings you to Queen's?
Yeah, for sure. I came to Queen's a few years ago now to do my master's in philosophy. Before that, I went to Swansea University in the UK for law school. And then before that, I was at Trent University for philosophy. So I decided to come to Queen's because I've heard great things about Kingston. It's a beautiful city. And then I decided to stay here, and I ended up doing my second master's in law here at Queen's under Dr. Jacob Weinrib. Mm. And then now I'm in my third year, my PhD here with Dr. Fairfield.
Oh, very nice. So you've been to many places.
Yes.
And studied, it sounds like, a variety of topics, which I'm sure sounds like they're converging in your PhD. So hopefully we can chat about that a little bit more. So your current dissertation research focuses on the American philosopher Albert Borgman. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what your project entails?
Yeah. So Albert Borgman was an American philosopher who was born in 1937 and actually passed away relatively recently in 2023. Mm. He wrote several books on the philosophy, namely of technology is what he's known for. But he also wrote about ethics, about ontology, philosophy of reality, philosophy of science, and a theory of history. So there's a lot more to Borgman than maybe is commonly known in the philosophical circles. And in terms of his specialty and what I'm working on, I'm actually trying to map, you know, his entire life and work and his legacy ultimately in like a master project. So up until now, you know, there's been a little bit of discussion about Borgman. Most of it is on his technology stuff, like I said, and a lot of it was happening in like the 90s when all this was, you know, getting popular. So a lot less so today. He's not a big name by any means in philosophy, but I'm hoping to kind of change that and introduce him back to a new generation of scholars. I think there's been a big dearth in terms of, you know, the philosophy of technology research generally, but then also having a more holistic picture of, you know, technology and what the good life means and what community means. And Borgman really sought to have a comprehensive project that answered all those questions. So my doctoral research is focused on then mainly three things. The first of which is, yes, to make the first long form book kind of treatment of Borgman's life and work instead of just, you know, there's a lot of essays and stuff, you know, applied work that I'm kind of looking at the big picture. And then secondly, to extend and defend a lot of the criticisms that kind of got unresolved in the literature back in the 80s and 90s. Borgman never directly resolved a lot of the problems that other people brought up with regards to some of his ideas and theories. And I feel like I might be able to kind of satisfy some of those questions. Mm-hmm. And of course, now that he's gone, he can't do it anymore. So I really want to answer those kind of lingering questions and criticisms. And then the third instance, I want to demonstrate Borgman's like continuing relevancy for today, both for, you know, the philosophy of technology, narrowly speaking, but also for, you know, a wider audience, because towards Borgman's later years, he really sought to write for a more general audience as well. He felt like that was the proper place for philosophy, is not always just a technical kind of puzzle or discussion among experts, but, you know, a wider drawing in of people. So that'd be my main three aspects of my project.
Oh, very interesting. Well, that sounds like a massive undertaking. It sounds like a lot of work to be done and that you're doing currently, but it sounds exciting. And how did you first become interested in Borgman, and why did you choose him in particular to focus your doctoral dissertation work on?
I began looking and reading at Borgman a long time ago, actually, during my undergrad for an essay I was writing. And I came across him by accident. I was reading a book that kind of talked about, in a general way, the history of philosophy of technology. But he really kind of stuck out to me. And I read his main book on technology, and I really liked that book. But I felt like there was a lot of questions that I found really interesting and that, you know, he didn't really answer. So I felt like there was a lot to discuss there. And actually, at first, when I read Borgman, I was quite critical of him. I felt like his theory was too optimistic and had too many questions, too many holes in it. But then the more that I've gone back and kind of read him for other assignments and other essays for different courses, I found, you know, how applicable he kind of is to everything. And I always knew that I wanted to do my dissertation on probably one philosopher versus a problem, because in philosophy, generally, you have a thesis or a dissertation that usually focuses on either like a problem, so like, you know, the question of truth or, you know, what is beauty, that kind of thing, or on a person. So, you know, there's a lot of people doing work on like Rawls or Heidegger or Nietzsche, you know, one of the big names. So I wanted to do a person, but I didn't want to do a big name, so to speak. I was looking forward to kind of carving out my own kind of corner to work on someone who is less known and maybe try to popularize his work and his ideas and kind of bring them forward. So Borgman really fit that because not only, you know, he's not a big name, and I do feel like he's been neglected. And, you know, the more I kind of thought about it, the more I realized he was right about like so many things. And the more I started to like reflect on his work and how it relates to my own life, you know, the more I started to feel like my own life became like better in some ways because of what he was saying and the influence he had, especially his work in ethics and, you know, kind of the virtues for daily life today, living in a technological society. And I really enjoyed his writing style, and I enjoyed his criticisms of philosophy in general. He was very critical of the profession towards the end of his career. So he said a lot of things that I can certainly relate to as a graduate student in the profession. And I found like he was a really just inspirational person the more I dug into his life and his work. So I really enjoyed kind of following his trail. I actually recently went to the University of Montana to do archival research there on his work. They hold an archive because he worked at the University of Montana for the last 50 years, actually.
Wow.
So he was there for 50 years, yes. And he had this house up in the mountain overlooking Rattlesnake Park, which is a wilderness conservation area. And it is just breathtaking. And going to Montana and like kind of seeing where he lived and where he worked and where he spent his time, like it you can see how much it informs his writing. And it definitely is a way of life that speaks to me as well. He was a big outdoorsman, hiker, a naturalist kind of person. So all of that really, really brought me into just studying Borgman.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And also that you were able to visit the site recently, right?
Yeah.
And that are all his personal papers there?
Yes.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
What a collection. 50 years of work and all of the ephemera that have come with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, very interesting. The unfortunate part was that a lot of his work is very handwritten. And like he used to write in pencil, like very, very tiny little cursive writing. So actually going through it is less fun, I will say. I do wish that more of it was typed, but he didn't, you know, he only typed usually the last draft. So it was just drafts and drafts of handwritten, very faint writing. So, but yeah, it was very cool to look at the archive and even get to meet some people, some of the other professors and the faculty who knew him, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to meet a few of those people and hear about kind of Borgman and his stories and, you know, what he was like as a philosopher kind of thing. So I'm hoping to go back to the University of Montana in the next few years and do more research and talk to more people about Borgman's life and legacy.
Oh, that is such a nice aspect of your project that maybe other folks who study philosophers from a more distant past don't have the ability to do. So it's so nice that you have both his words, his thoughts, but also this community with which to discuss his work and his life. So that is very exciting. And you mentioned in kind of your summary of your work that Borgman is really focused, or I guess his most known work is for his work on technology. And in our contemporary moment, technology, especially different types of, you know, generative artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. that seems to be kind of everywhere, kind of inescapable and kind of very front of mind for many people. So mm-hmm. does Borgman offer anything that's really unique or illuminating on the current moment we find ourselves in? And can he offer things to both philosophers and non-philosophers that we should be considering?
Yeah. In terms of Borgman's philosophy of technology, I would say the first thing is that it was very prescient in terms of he wrote his main book in 1984. Mm. And a lot of the things he talks about in that book, you know, have only come more true as time goes on. And I really do like that in a philosopher, when philosophers kind of have this ability to kind of like look to the future and make, you know, these kind of long-term predictions, and then they turn out right. I think that's a real success for philosophers. I think in some sense that is very impressive. So in terms of his philosophy of technology today, I would say that it certainly has a lot to offer the general discussion on technology. Mm. A lot of the philosophy of technology today coming out of, you know, academic philosophy deals with specific, you know, technologies, mainly the idea that, you know, we need to examine the benefits and, you know, issues with this one type of technology. You know, for example, you see a lot of the discussion on social media, you know, how does social media like harm people? What are the harms? Or, you know, what does free speech mean on social media? You know, these kinds of very specific questions that are very important to policy. They're very important to research and development of these technologies. But there is, I think, missing a big picture kind of look at technology as a whole that we kind of saw back in the 50s and 60s with thinkers like Heidegger, who wrote about the question concerning technology as this kind of big way of being in the world today. And Borgman really followed Heidegger in a lot of that, in terms of interpreting technology as the way we are in the world to some extent. And Borgman made it more specific, though, to, you know, our specific relationships. So his central philosophy of technology that he elucidates in his first book is that technology disrupts our relationships with, obviously, each other. Mm. You know, there's a lot of discussion about that, but also with our material world, our environments, and the things itself, right? Mm. So his whole theory he called back then was called the device paradigm. And he argued that devices were things that delivered us a product without any kind of skill or engagement with, you know, the world or with the device itself, right? And his example is a thermostat. You know, you go over and you click the button and now your house is getting warm. Mm. So with very little effort and no skill, no attention, no engagement needed, you know, you've now made your house warm. Mm-hmm. Versus before, you know, modern technology, before the, you know, the invention of central heating, you know, making your house warm would require, you know, effort, hours of effort of, you know, collecting the wood and building the fire, the knowledge and skill on how to start a fire, how to keep the fire going. You know, there's usually some kind of social, you know, grouping that kind of made the decisions on who keeps a fire going. So in a small family, it might be younger children who are in charge of that. In a, you know, big castle, it might be some of the servants. So there was this whole, like, wider context that wasn't just about making your house warm. It fed into this kind of reality that brought things together, right? Mm-hmm. There was a kind of engagement there. So his argument is that technological devices, he called them, interrupt or disrupt that kind of engagement with our bodily world. And, you know, there obviously is great, you know, devices that have brought us a lot of benefits. He talks about, for example, the invention of vaccines obviously prevented, you know, horrible childhood illnesses that, you know, unfortunately killed so many children back then. But at the same time, you know, he does note that kind of experience of going through a life-threatening childhood illness as a child. And he talks about his experience as a kid growing up in, you know, the 40s and you know, suffering from, I forget which disease he's talking about. But, you know, he remembers how, you know, vivid the fever dreams were. And for him, that was a formative experience, but it's definitely experience we can move beyond now, right? Mm-hmm. So he definitely does distinguish between, you know, the benefits of technology and, you know, the drawbacks. But he thinks that, you know, there's been a little bit too, we're going too far in the one direction towards more and more easy availability of things, right? Mm. Fast food's another great example. Like, you literally just go and you order it, well, you order it on the window or on the app, and then it just, you know, appears and you get this meal, and you don't really have any of idea where the food came from. Like, you know, you don't know the cow that the beef came from. You don't know the people who even made it. It's made in a very uniform way, you know. So that's another example of kind of, he calls it commodity. So what a device is for is a commodity. So a burger from McDonald's would be a commodity. The heat that you get from your thermostat is a commodity. And he means that in not the sense of we might think of a commodity, but a commodity for him is just the way that something has been severed from its context. Mm-hmm. So when you, you know, take a burger and you mass produce it in a factory and then produce it at McDonald's or whatever, it's been taken from its context, right? Compared with, you know, actually you raising the cattle and slaughtering it and going through that whole process, that's something in its context. So anyway, his theory of technology then is really, I think, accurate in a lot of ways. And I think it's, even though he's writing this in the 80s, I think we can only see today how our lives have become more deviceness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not in, literally in the sense of we have, you know, iPads and smartwatches and stuff
yes.
that literally give us anything we want at the push of a button. You know, Gen AI, ChatGPT, like, is kind of the ultimate device. It will tell you anything you want at the push of a button. And then you have to ask, like, you know, is that good for us? Is that good for our relationship with the wider world? You know, is it, you know, is there something missing when instead of, you know, going out in the world and meeting people, you know, you're just sitting on your iPad and texting, mm-hmm. you know, is there some kind of engagement loss there? You know, and I think part of that is trying to steer us away from the feeling that we need things easier and easier and faster and better, or else we're going to be unsatisfied. It's kind of, you know, like the hedonic treadmill, right? We're just kind of, mm-hmm. we need more and more and more. And Borgman really has a clear line that, you know, we don't, and there's, you know, there's something good to be found in effort and engagement with the world. And we need to kind of have a mature relationship with technology, he argues, insofar as we need to limit devices and our use to them to, you know, what is strictly necessary, like, you know, vaccines, and then, you know, make more room for what he calls focal practices. And for Borgman, a focal thing or focal practice is something that you can center your life around. So historical examples would be like religion, which, you know, in medieval Europe was a very focally oriented society insofar mm-hmm. as the church and, you know, God was the center of all of society. And from there, you know, people knew what they were doing, what their meaning in life is. It was all given to you, right? Insofar as being part of that kind of world. And obviously today we don't have that kind of center focality in most cultures, but we definitely can still have forms of individual focality, things that make our lives worth living, that give us meaning, that give us orientation, and that give us a way to engage with the world and with each other. And so the examples he talks a lot about are sports. Mm-hmm. Sports bring a lot of people together. Yeah. They engage the body, they engage the mind. There's a kind of excellence there that you can work towards as an individual, which is you know, a really good way to be in the world, so to speak. Art, music, gardening, mm-hmm. cooking, you know, having a family, having something you're proud of. Those kinds of things he thinks are orienting and focal. And we, you know, instead of, you know, turning to technology to make our lives easier and easier, we should be using technology instead to make more room for these kinds of practices. Mm-hmm. You know, his famous example is you can either sit at home all day and, you know, sit on the couch, or you could go for a run and then come home and have a shower, and the shower then facilitates, you know, the ease of the run. Then if it's raining outside, you don't have to be like, oh, I don't want to go outside and, you know, go for a run in the rain. You can be like, well, I can because I'll come home and shower. So in that way, you know, we're using the device of a shower mm-hmm. in a way to promote kind of the focal practice of running. So in that sense, that's how we should be kind of looking at devices, instead of thinking about how more and more we can, you know, use devices to make our lives easier, right? And I think, as you said, generative AI, I think, is a really good example of how we're moving in the opposite direction, mm-hmm. where, you know, instead of mm-hmm. AI doing my laundry, AI is like making art mm-hmm. and, like, you mm-hmm. know, like stealing work from people and reproducing it. And, you know, that's kind of the unfortunate part, because that's going the opposite direction. We should be, you know, kind of centering around, you know, those kinds of things, instead of, you know, ceding it to, you know, what is easy, what is available, what is convenient, what is effortless, and kind of, yeah. So I feel like that's definitely a prescient aspect of his thought.
Well, it sounds, like you said, very prescient for the time right now, especially as we're seeing lots of, you know, the general public and just regular everyday folks asking themselves, mm-hmm. like, you know, like, what is the point of doing certain things when mm-hmm. something else, like Gen mm-hmm. AI, might be able to use that? And people are really balancing, you know, what are they gaining, what are they losing mm-hmm. from using, and I guess Borgman's words, using these devices, like, what do you gain, what do you lose? And mm-hmm. I think we need to have a serious conversation as a mm-hmm. society right now, and it sounds like Borgman can really offer us a lot to think about, you know, what are the benefits and what are the challenges by using different types of technology, and what are we willing to give up and what are we willing to hold on to
yeah.
as we move forward. Do you have a favorite passage passage of Borgman's work?
Yeah, I do.
Ooh, can you tell us? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so this passage didn't appear in any of his published work until his final book, which was published posthumously in 2023. It's called Moral Cosmology, and it's kind of a collection of the stuff he was working on towards the end of his career. And unfortunately, it is kind of unfinished in the sense that he unfortunately passed away before he could finish the last chapter and kind of polish it up. So it definitely reads like that, but you can kind of see his aim at the end of that was to tie together his kind of life's work in the sense that, you know, he started with, you know, the technology question, and then he continued through his theory of history, and he talks a lot about ethics in his Real American Ethics book in 2006. So this book was kind of a way to draw it all together and kind of see, you know, what role that we have to play in, you know, the world, people, and then what is the role between, you know, science and the humanities? He talked a lot about that. And, you know, can we have a cosmology today? And a cosmology is kind of just a fancy word for saying, can we have an explanation for, like, why we're here and what we're doing here, right? And, you know, historically, like, all cultures have a moral cosmology, right? Like, you know, Christian Europe has a very clear Christian cosmology of, you know, how the world began and, you know, where it's going. Indigenous cultures have a very clear cosmology. He talks a lot about that as well. But we obviously don't have one anymore in, you know, kind of secular Western society. And so he's trying to see if we can take, you know, from science, you know, and kind of build up a theory of the universe that's, you know, not incorrect in terms of a physics way, but gives us some kind of purpose and meaning. So that project is a bit unfinished for sure. But he at the end of the book, he cites this passage, and I think it illuminates what I was talking about earlier with focal practices. You know, I keep using the word orientation, and that's a really funny word. It's a weird word you don't hear a lot anymore. You think, what do you mean, like, orient? Like, you know, this passage kind of illuminates what he means by orientation, what he means by having a focal thing or focal practice that centers your world. And in his later work, you know, he talks a lot about completeness. You know, we want to have a complete life, a complete world. And, you know, the kind of consumerist hedonic treadmill that we're on today and technology kind of promotes is not complete. It never can be complete, right? You can never buy too much stuff. There's always more stuff to buy. There's always more, you know, devices to have. You can always make something easier and better and more quickly available or whatever it is. And that's not a complete life. And for that reason, there's this feeling of incompleteness. So this passage is kind of illustrates what Borgman means by completeness. And as he calls it, you know, it's kind of self-warranting. Like, you know, you don't then need to define necessarily, you know, what is a focal practice. What focal practice is kind of centering. So the quote is, "There is no place I would rather be. There is no one I would rather be with. There is nothing I would rather do. And this I will remember well." And that passage actually he got from a retreat he went on back in the 50s, this Christian retreat, and he was speaking with a theologian there, and that he talks about this in actually an earlier interview, 1993 interview, but it comes back up in this final book, and then that's in the last page actually, and I think that's also very fitting. And so basically the idea is that, you know, to have a complete life, to have a focal life, or to be involved in a focal practice is kind of to be able to say, wow, like, there's no place I would rather be than eating dinner with my family, or there's nothing I would rather do than, you know, be out here running, you know. And I think we've all had that feeling from time to time, right? It's kind of like a sublime, or as people might call it flow state in psychology, right? And he says, you know, we need to be, that is what the good life is. That's a source of the good life that gives us all purpose and meaning. It's kind of a universal. And in that sense, we should be focusing on making a clearing for those kinds of experiences more, right? And the technology, he thinks, you know, obviously drastically reduces those experiences because it reduces our engagement with the world, and it reduces the way we might randomly come across something or someone that we're doing, and suddenly we're really actually involved in this focal thing, right? I really like that quote at the end. I think it's a very fitting kind of quote.
It's a nice, yeah, like you said, I think it's a nice summation of what you've been discussing and kind of a way to recognize when you're hitting those focal practices or those focal things. A nice way for you to quickly recognize if this is something that is worth your good life and the time that you have to spend on it. Thank you for sharing that. What do you want people to know about philosophy in general and the role that philosophy can play in today's world as it rapidly changes and careens around? What do you want people to know about it?
It's a difficult question to answer because I feel like every philosopher is going to have a different answer. So by no means do I mean to speak for, you know, the academic philosophy profession as a whole. But I'm going to have to agree with Borgman insofar as I feel like philosophy today has become very narrow in the sense that there's a lot of people, a lot of really great work being done, a lot of diligent projects. But the projects are kind of just self-reinforcing projects. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, they're working on these really difficult technical questions, and there's a lot of collaboration with other philosophers on these kinds of questions, but there's not a lot of willingness to go beyond that kind of technical debate. Mm-hmm. You know, philosophy used to be, you know, at the base of everything. You know, that's where we got math and the physical sciences from, and mm-hmm. art, you know, everything was once, you know, full under the branch of philosophy, right? And over time, you know, all those pieces have kind of left and gone off to do, you know, their own thing, right? And philosophy's now been kind of left with this question of like, well, you know, what is my purpose now, right? Like kind of a retired person might be like, well, I spent my whole life working, you know, now what do I do with my free time? And I think that's caused a lot of disruption in terms of, you know, the discipline. So I'd say that a lot of the philosophers today are working on great projects, but I think they need to extend more and be maybe a little more speculative and daring. And I say that only because I work particularly in the continental tradition. So that's the tradition that came from continental Europe, is starting in the 1700s, and includes, you know, the big names like Heidegger, Nietzsche, Camus, the existentialist, Sartre. And those philosophers were more willing to take on more of a narrative or artistic style. They were often very dramatic. If anyone's ever read Nietzsche, like, he's very, very dramatic. He's almost to the point of being funny. And they're very polemic in a lot of instances. They have a lot to say about things. And, you know, today the predominant style of philosophy is analytic philosophy, which came from, you know, the Anglo-Saxon sphere around the World War I, World War II. And that is closer related to kind of, you know, the sciences or maths, mm-hmm. where they set out to solve a specific problem. So like formal logic, for example, and they set out like, you know, a logical problem. There's a lot of great work being done in analytic moral theory, which questions, you know, in this case, what should we do? You know, the trolley problem, I'm sure people have heard about. Those are all very classical kind of analytic questions. And so their style is a lot more formal and a lot more, I would say, kind of limited in the sense that they're trying to be as clear and succinct as possible mm-hmm. in their answers, which is great. But I think that there is room to do, you know, the continental kind of side of philosophy too. And I don't think there's anything wrong with a philosophy that does seek to be more speculative and more polemic, especially when we're talking about stuff like technology today, where there is lots of great work being done on, you know, the effects of this technology or that technology mm-hmm. or what have you. But I also think there's room for a lot more, I would say, drama almost and polemicism for sure. And I think that would also bring the general public more into conversation, because I think there's been a lot of fragmentation where the general public doesn't know what philosophy is anymore, what people are doing in it. And then, you know, philosophers are just kind of like, oh, well, they don't understand. They don't like us. You know, there's, you know, kind of a inferiority complex among all philosophers, I think, that, you know, we're not the hard sciences. And what mm-hmm. are we doing here? And I think that kind of inferiority or insecurity complex is something that all philosophers deal with. Even, I would assume, maybe even, you know, the ones who are famous and have great, you know, are, you know, deans of departments and stuff, I feel like even they must sometimes be like, wow, like, you know, because it's hard to do something that the rest of the world just doesn't respect mm-hmm. or feel like it's worthy. So that can be very difficult, especially when you're starting out in your career and people are like, well, why don't you go be a lawyer, or why don't you go do something useful for society? But the best philosophers, I feel like, were ones who were doing a public service. They're public philosophers, right? So Dewey was another big public philosopher in America in the early 20s. Borgman really tried to be kind of a public figure. So in that sense, I think philosophy should be very public. It should be community oriented. And I think it should inform a lot of the kind of public conversations that we're having. And so in that sense, I think there's a lot of room for philosophy to do that today. And I hope that there kind of is more of that in the years to come.
I think people would welcome some philosophers' opinions on things, because right now I think, like you mentioned, there's not one central focal point for, you know, secular Western society. Mm-hmm. And I think people are searching for that. Mm-hmm. There may be multiple, of course, but mm-hmm. I think people would love to hear more from philosophers and their opinions on where we can find meaning. Mm-hmm. I think that is very, very important in the contemporary moment. Mm-hmm. Well, Abigail, thank you so much. It has been wonderful chatting with you and learning about your work on Borgman and how his ideas have influenced different aspects of your mm-hmm. life. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
My name is Jean Legault, Science 82, former CFRC alumnus, jazz director from 1980 to 1982. I'm thrilled to be back on campus. I can't describe how important CFRC was to me, not only as a training ground, it helped me develop my confidence in public speaking, and as far as my love of music, was developed directly from this station. The wealth of records back then, we didn't even have CDs, and the people, the terrific volunteers that were here. I want to thank CFRC, and I'm really pleased, and I'm amazed at the technology that's here, and I'm wishing you all the best of success. This is Jean Legault for CFRC 101.9 FM.
When I was a child, Timonides, I had a secret fear that night would come and would never end, that we would live out our lives in total darkness. It was a small fear then.
Dark Side of the Tune has returned, and now at an even darker time spot. Tune in on Thursdays at 9 p.m. to get your dose of alternative music, including but not limited to metal, grunge, goth, and more. Hope to see you there.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road each week on Sundays from 8 to 9 p.m., and I've got a show for you. Tune in to get your weekly fix of British music, culture, and lots of fun. I'll see you there. Ta-ra!
In my Mersey paradise.
Today on Wings, Alexandrine Benjamin, an award-winning young Haitian filmmaker, tells how she came to produce her award-winning short film about a pregnant Haitian couple traversing the countryside by motorcycle during an uprising in search of a safe place to give birth.
The desire to create that specific film came out of frustration.
Haitians' frustrations are generally over broken government promises, fueled by well over 200 years of constant international interference. Stay tuned.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Suki Westling, host of The Babblery, produced this program for Wings.
Independent filmmaker Alexandrine Benjamin was born and raised in Haiti. She made her way through school, eventually got a master's in film from the University of Greenwich in Great Britain, and she currently lives in Puerto Rico. But the heart and soul of her filmmaking is the country of her birth. When she speaks about taking action to change things, it's not empty talk. Her early work was on a television show promoting literacy in Haiti, and her first film is Not Boule, a short drama about a couple trying to get to the hospital to give birth.
Not Boule tells the story of Jean and Rose, a modest Haitian couple who embark on a perilous journey during pays d'Afrique, solely to find a hospital where they can give birth safely. On their small bike, you know, riding through unpaved roads, they had to face like warlords, they are threatened with gunfires. And, you know, they had to face so many hardships. But even despite that, they persevere. The film was set during the PAIGLOC, which is a socio-political movement that emerged in Haiti back in 2018, I think. You know, about $4 billion that went missing. And people wanted to know what happened with the money. So they started a whole movement. And that movement turned into a violent series of events where people would get gunned down or kidnapped.
The film takes place during a time that Haitians refer to as PAIGLOC, or locked down country. Alexandrine explains with more detail what happened during this time.
You know, Haiti, I mean, the country is known for very billion, you know, country. So we have suffered from a lot of injustice from other nations, you know, people with very bad intentions. So we tend to, you know, just stand against stuff very rapidly. But that particular movement, which is PAIGLOC, is something that for the first time in my whole life, I've seen Haitian people align behind a specific thing. You know, so the whole country, we had movement in every of the 10 departments, and people, they wanted retribution. They wanted to understand what happened with that money. And then suddenly, nobody understood what was happening, you know, because we had some people who they were, you know, they weren't that involved as they were before. And then they started to, you know, just discrediting the movement. And it all went sideways. And it's hard because the only thing that we wanted was to, you know, understand what happened to that money. And we thought, I thought that this was going to be a starting point for us as a nation to get people to deliver what they promised and to, you know, give report. Because politicians, elected people in Haiti, they do not report to Haitians, unfortunately. And we are not used to ask, you know, like force people to give us to work, because that's why what we're electing them for. So over the years, you know, the movement just died, which is a shame because so many people lost their lives over this. I was, you know, I went to several protests myself. I've lost friends, you know, during that protest. So it was supposed to be rewarding at the end, but we still don't know what happened to the money.
Haiti currently has no functioning parliament and is governed by a transitional presidential council. Gangs control neighborhoods and whole cities. Many Haitians, like Alexandrine, have fled Haiti. The political situation has led to a breakdown in systems of care, especially for pregnant Haitian women. Alexandrine's short feature, Not Boule, has PAIGLOC as a backdrop as Jean and Rose journey through their city, experiencing robbery, abuse, and a gunshot to Jean's leg. But their destination, a safe place to give birth, is the point of the film.
When they finally got into the hospital where their suffering should end, it wasn't the case because the staff were worsening their situation because they refused to provide them with the necessary care. And, you know, it's a very pregnant story, but it's authentic. It reflects our reality back then and even more so today.
Before the current unrest, Haiti was already in crisis with their maternal mortality rate, which has been estimated at around 350 deaths per 100,000 births after the devastating 2021 earthquake. Alexandrine says that women who were able would cross into the Dominican Republic to give birth, but the DR has secured the border in response to widespread violence in Haiti. Now Haitian women must navigate unsafe living conditions, dangerous streets, and expensive hospital care in order to get treatment. Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, runs clinics in some of the most affected areas, where hospitals have been closed due to violence, but current services don't meet the needs of the population. Alexandrine relates how a canceled family visit while she was studying film at the University of Greenwich inspired the story.
The desire to create that specific film came out of frustration. It was winter of 2020 actually. I had been away for a while studying in London, and it started to be cold, like very cold, and I do not like cold. So I wanted to go back to Haiti, like spending Christmas with my friends and family, but I couldn't because all of the violence going on would prevent me to. And, you know, at the time, several neighborhoods in the capital were blocked by armed bandits. And the road leading to Jacmel, my hometown, was closed through Martissant, which is like, you know, a very big neighborhood region in Port-au-Prince. So, you know, I started to vent with a friend, you know, he's now my husband, about how such action could impact so many aspects of people's life in Haiti, especially pregnant women. And that's when he told me that he had written a short treatment for a story similar to this and asked if I wanted to develop it. And, you know, at the time I was working on my final thesis, the subject for my final thesis, and I just jumped on the opportunity because I really saw how, you know, the potential, because, you know, I was studying in London. I know producing a film with the university would have the opportunity to show it to so many, in so many places in the world. And I thought, yeah, this is the best way to do it.
Getting support to shoot a film in a country with no functioning government was difficult, but the project was greenlighted and Alexandrine started work from across the ocean with her actors and technical crew.
It was crazy, you know, to be honest. Everybody, like the university members, my families, my friends, they all advised me not to go back, like, you know, and to shoot that specific movie. I remember the university, they wanted to let me use their equipment, but the insurance company said, no, they won't allow their equipment to go to such a country with some, imagine me, a whole person, and I'm going there. But, you know, I have a lot of friends, a lot of people who believe in me. I also have my former film school. You know, I had very good relationship with them. And when I went to them with the idea, they all agreed to support me. And I didn't go back to Haiti until a month before the shoot. So I had to, like, work remotely with everybody from, you know, the main characters, my team, the head of departments, like director of photography, sound man, director of production design, the production designer, my assistant director, production manager, everybody. And let me tell you, those people, they made La Boule. And if it weren't for them, this movie wouldn't be. When I was ready to go back to Haiti, everything was like set. I just had to visit, you know, the locations.
Shooting the film turned out to be a drama of its own.
During shooting, things went sideways. I mean, I wasn't like, it's not like I was surprised because I know, you know, what the country was like. And that's actually the reason we decided to shoot in Jacmel, which is the southern part of Haiti, because most violence was happening in Port-au-Prince. So we thought, you know, shooting in Jacmel, I am from Jacmel. My friends, my team, my crew members, they are all from Jacmel. So we're going to be fine. But that, you know, it didn't happen like that. Some people, powerful people in Haiti, in Jacmel, when they see you with a camera, they are afraid that you are going to show, you know, what they are doing underneath. So we were attacked like two, three times, I think. One time a guy came on the set and he pulled out a gun and he said that we had to stop. And I was like, I was like, who are you? Because he came and asked who is responsible. So then, for some reason, someone came to get me from set. So I went out and I was like, yeah, that's me. You know, I'm studying. I'm producing this short film for my, you know, thesis project. And then he was like, I'm not interested in what you're saying. I just need you guys to back it. You know, just fake it. I don't want you here. I was like, but who are you? Because we have permission from, you know, the mayor's office, from the police department. And he was like, I am an authority. I am a chief, you know, like, but I'm trying to get someone to get me my authorization. He's like, look, lady, I need you out of here. So I just went back to the team and be like, guys, we're not going to finish it today. I asked him for about an hour to just wrap. He's like, you have 30 minutes. So we wrapped up and, you know, we just left the scene. And that's it. And I remember another time we were doing the scene where the tires are being burned. And then a guy came and he was like, I mean, what are you doing? This is my neighborhood. I govern here. You know, you can't be here without my permission, something like that. And it was crazy. And that's actually one of the reasons we were able to shoot everything that we were supposed to shoot. And in the middle of this, the former president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated. So we had to stop production for about 3 days. And I mean, I wasn't even sure that we were going to be able to complete the film because we weren't sure of what was going to happen after that assassination. But my team was like, no, we came too far. We can't just, you know, we can't just leave everything and just, no, we can't. So we stopped for about three days actually, and then we resumed production. So yeah, basically, you know, we were able to shoot the essential, but production wasn't easy at all.
Madame, qui enceinte, besoin accoucher. S'il vous plaît, madame, fais mon médecin. Un docteur, s'il vous plaît.
Madame Mongondo, c'est ici là.
Non, pas gagné, non.
I'm your host, Suki Wessling, and you're listening to Wings. We're speaking with Alexandrine Benjamin, a Haitian filmmaker whose first film, Nap Boule, takes place in Haiti during a period of unrest known as Pays Loc. Alexandrine had hired actors whose work she knew from theater, and she had hoped for more time for preparation. It turned out, however, that the perilous life that her actors had been living was preparation enough.
We stayed at the same hotel. We worked for about 2 weeks, I think, you know, just really to get to know each other and for them to get the chemistry going too. Because to me, I mean, for a film like Nap Boule, which is something that we all live every day in Haiti, I don't think the acting is really necessary. You just need to get to understand the situation you're in, you know, understand the reality, and then you just let it flow. So we rehearsed a couple of scenes, which was the one on the motorcycle. We rehearsed the opening scene. We also rehearsed the one where the gang members slapped Rose.
Alexandrine Benjamin's own story starts with a strong female role model and a necessity to stand up for herself.
I came from a family of three children. I am in the middle, but we all have sisters. You know, our fathers were never there, you know. So my mom, she educated us, you know, the way she could. She is a very strong woman. I mean, I've seen my mom doing so many things. As an adult now, I just don't understand how she managed to do all of this. And in the middle of that was the fact that we somehow helped educating ourselves as well, because she was traveling often, you know, trying to go buy stuff so that she can resell, stuff like that. And we would stay at home. And I've witnessed a lot of injustice in a whole yard. That's how people live in Haiti. We have like big courtyard with many different households. And I witnessed so many injustices that I developed that rebellion aspect of not doing exactly what people tell me to do. Like, I become an adult very young, okay? So I had to figure this out by myself and try to go places, to speak to people, to read, to do so many stuff so that I could help raise myself. with my mom. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's how I got into activism, you know, because there was a lot of beatings, you know, husbands beating their wives, parents beating their kids so hard. It was very sad, frustrating at the same time. So, you know, I started to find a, you know, I found a purpose, you know, just make myself useful to something. And yeah, I got into activism and later got into filmmaking because, you know, people, they like to ask me this question, how did you get into filmmaking? Like, it's a lot. I didn't get into creating movies because, I wanted to do art. I wanted to help. And I just realized that filmmaking can help with that. And I decided to do filmmaking.
Alexandrine remembers one particular couple who shaped her consciousness about the plight of women in Haiti.
There was that couple. They rent a room from my mom. They weren't married, but they were together and they have a child. And then the woman, she is a very nice woman, you know. She would stay at home, prepare food for her husband when, you know, the guy is back. And every single day the guy is back, he just keeps beating the, for no reason, he would get his, how do you say, homosexual? Let me find out. This is very important. I need to know.
His belt?
Belt. Thank you. He would get his belt, you know, and start beating the lady for no reason. And she would cry so hard. And my heart was, the guy, he was like trying. There wasn't much I could do. But the worst part was the fact that there were other people in the area. They would just stare. I mean, in our culture, I mean, maybe some things have changed. But back then, your husband was allowed to beat you. So if someone finds out that you are getting beaten by your husband, their first question is, what did you do? You know, like they're trying to justify the reason why you're getting beaten. And I was like, that woman is an adult. She isn't supposed to get beaten because whatever she did, she just doesn't deserve that, you know? So I started to get involved with advocacy organizations, working with gender equity and stuff like that, trying to educate myself and then go back to my community and try to, you know, talk to people way older than me, you know, but trying to help them understand that, okay, so if something is happening, you know, maybe you can try to, you know, speak up, you know, like have a conversation with that person to understand, but that, you know, your wife isn't like some drum. You can't keep beating your wife like this, you know? So this really stayed with me for a long time because it wasn't like a situation. It don't happen often, you know, in different households, but it was very common. And I wanted to help. I don't know if I helped, but I know I spoke to a lot of people. Some of them wouldn't like listen to me, but I know that particular lady, she fled the town. She I don't know where she went. Oh, I heard she went to DR. But I left that place for a while. When I came back, she wasn't there. They told me that she went away and, you know, she just, and I was so happy for her because I know this can't be good.
Haiti's history has been one of conquest and domination. Alexandrine Benjamin's view is that as much as Haitians have been supported by organizations from outside the country, they won't be able to move forward until they start to define themselves for themselves.
One thing is that we need to stop studying or educating kids with books that are from outside, you know, because most schools in Haiti, I mean, we have a lot of congressional schools. They have books that came from outside and that is what they use to educate children. And the culture that we are being taught is not really authentic. So if we don't really know who we are, if we don't get the authentic version of the Haitian history, it's going to be really hard, you know, to appreciate who we are and where we came from. Mm-hmm. And just last month, I think there was like a big, you know, discussion on the internet about an economist who said something about, you have to stop. How can I put it? Should I talk about that? It's complex, you know. I mean, the way I see it, he meant the fact that we need to do something and stop relying on what our ancestor did, you know, because it was 1804. So we need to start doing something for ourselves. And people weren't happy at all. They thought that he meant that we need to forget about them and stuff like that. But in fact, Haitians, it's a very complex nation, you know. Our past, I believe, interfere with, you know, our daily lives, and we don't even realize it, you know. Some kind of behaviors that we may have, for example, not trusting each other. This is a very big issue in Haiti. We do not trust each other. And you may suddenly know that any good relationship starts with believing, trusting each other. If I don't trust you, I can't have a good collaboration with you. You know, there's nothing good we can do because we are still waiting for when you're going to do something that will like hurt me because we've been hurt so much in the past. How do you get that out of the Haitian mind? Because we're not even aware that we're like that. You know, it's not even a thing for us. And I think every Haitian should include therapy as part of the curriculum in Haiti, you know, because we are so here and we do not know that. We need treatment. We need to treat ourselves. We need love. You know, we need understanding from each other. And the amount of violence that is going on in Haiti right now came from that, because we suffered so much from a tiny part of people who believe that they are the one, that Haiti's profit, everything is theirs. And those people with their guns, to me, it is their way of reacting to that injustice. And now that they have tasted power, they do not want to hold back. And I mean, miracles exist. That's a good thing, because where we are, I'm not sure how we are getting out of it. Haitians, they get food easily and they can't understand. I mean, they feel like there will be some kind of savior coming to save them when we are supposed to save ourselves. I mean, I know that some of our policies, you know, in Haiti, it's like a cake. Everybody is trying to get their part. But Haitians shouldn't let the political state of another country impact our country the way it is right now, because we are a nation and we took our freedom for a reason, you know? So we should be our primary support, you know? We should be the one standing for our people and take actions in Haiti to change things.
Not Boulay was Alexandrine's final thesis for her film program at University of Greenwich. Though she says it was hard to be away from home in a place where she saw very few Black people and was the only Black student in her program, the film ended up being more important than the degree.
The most interesting thing is that I completed those studies and I made Not Boulay. Not Boulay is, it's not just a project. I think for the past 3 years, Not Boulay has been some kind of therapy for me, you know, allowing me to connect with people every now and then. And it keeps me grounded, you know, reminding me why I decided to make the choices that I made. And that even though it can be hard now, you know, but at some point, I'm gonna get to where I am. I meant to, you know. It's very important for me to keep creating content that can impact people's lives in a positive way. Even though now I cannot exactly do what I'm supposed to be doing, but you know, things will change.
Thanks to Alexandrine Benjamin for sharing her experiences and her vision of how Haiti could be. Learn more at alexandrinebee.com. Her next project will be a feature film called O Negatif about the impact of HIV in Haiti. This is Suki Wessling of The Babblery at babblery.com. Thanks for listening.
Music and sound effects in this program are from Alexandrine Benjamin's award-winning film, Na Boule. A longer version of this interview will be released in Suki Wessling's podcast series, The Babble.